Good evening, everyone. You've tuned in to Paradigm Shifters, and guess what? We have quite the paradigm shifter tonight. This is a wonderful nutritionist who's going to talk to us about the GMO controversy. We're here in Washington State where there's going to be a big bill about labeling GMOs or not. So welcome to the show, Tom Maltaire, a nutritionist from Bellingham. Welcome, welcome.
Thank you so much. It's such a pleasure to be here with you.
Well, I'm really excited to talk to you. I went to one of your lectures recently. And you know what's interesting to me is I don't know who to believe and why with the whole GMO controversy. But you explained some things that I begin to understand, which is that some of the GMO products antidote nutritional content in our food. Is that right?
Antidote nutritional content in our food. Could you please
like you
clarify?
Said, it seemed to knock out the tryptophan and the, you know, some of the components of protein. And what are the results when it alters our nutritional base? What happens to people, kids, and what happens?
Well, the reality is, Veronica, we have no idea what's going to happen, what is happening, and what has happened to human beings because there are no human clinical trials. So the reality is all the safety trials have been offered by the industry that's actually giving the products to the marketplace at large. So when you're going to run a test, for example, they'll run it commonly on rats, and they'll run the safety, quote-unquote, studies for 90 days. And what we're seeing from the literature is 90 days may not be adequate considering the effects from GM products, genetically modified products, or from the pesticides associated with the genetically modified products may take longer than 90 days to show statistical significance in the animals. And there has never, ever, once again, been any sort of human data at all. So we don't know if the food is lower in nutritional value that is ending up in the humans. We do know that there are a few trials showing that dairy cows, for example, will be lower in things like B12 or manganese when they are exposed to foods that have been sprayed with glyphosate, which is the active ingredient in Roundup. So backtrack a little bit and say that the primary genetically modified crops that we're seeing in the United States marketplace have two traits, one of which is they are pesticide producing. Things like BT corn, for example, BT toxin, is produced by every single cell in the corn. Or there is an herbicide resistant strain, which is the Roundup Ready crops that everybody's familiar with that were the initial crops introduced into the mass food supply in 1996. So they are specifically genetically modified. They recombine their DNA with a specific gene from a bacterium that leaves them resistant to Roundup. So even though normal plants, when they're sprayed with Roundup, Roundup will, via its activity, its mechanism of action, it will very tightly bind to a mineral cofactor called manganese, and it will sequester that manganese so the plant cannot use it for photosynthesis, cannot use it to produce things like tryptophan, phenylalanine, tyrosine, which is a group of aromatic amino acids. It can't do it. The actual herbicide mechanism of action is to impede that process. So the implication then would be, are the plants then that are exposed to Roundup, are they then less likely to have higher levels of tryptophan? And then would those tryptophan levels be lower than in the animal? And we do see some studies indicating that. Now, would they be lower in humans? There are no human trials, so we don't know.
But can I ask you a question? Because it seems to me that we have huge, huge levels of anxiety and depression in our civilization. It's on a huge upswing. Couldn't they make a statement about that, about breaking the food or interjecting Roundup?
Well, sure, sure. There was an interesting paper with quite a few references in the journal Entropy by Stephanie Seneff and Anthony Samsel that looked at the introduction of Roundup-ready crops, the use of glyphosate, the active ingredient in Roundup, which now has lost its patent, so you'll see lots of other herbicides that are using that active ingredient. And what they've seen is that the more this glyphosate has been used, the likelihood of some of the issues you're talking about, anxiety, depression, and they also mentioned autism, could be affected. and that the mechanisms of action that are altered in plants and animals may have an effect downstream of what could occur in humans. And there was actually a local gal, a physicist out on Lummi Island named Nancy Swanson, who's done correlation coefficient data. So she looked at the statistics and said, okay, here is the increased rise of autism. Here is the increased use of glyphosate in GE crops. And she found a correlation coefficient of 0.985. So your tightest correlation, of course, is a 1. So that's pretty darn close to say that there may be some sort of correlation between the rise in the use of glyphosate and GE crops and the rise in autism. And that paper breaks down the individual mechanisms, showing how it could affect sulfation, could affect tryptophan, could affect many, many, many factors.
I think that's really interesting. And, you know, way back when, do you remember there was a big, terrible illness called pellagra? Do you remember that?
Yes, I'm familiar with pellagra. Mm-hmm.
Pardon? You are? Well, it amazed me that they found out that it was there was a missing ingredient, which was B3. That component created...
Niacin. Dermatitis, yeah. Dementia, and death were the byproducts of the niacin insufficiency. Yeah, and, you know, that was the non-mixed corn, so they weren't treating it with lime. That makes sense in that, you know, if you are knocking out a specific nutrient in the food supply, or in that particular case, not making it bioavailable, then, it would be a challenge.
So I keep seeing there's a parallel here. I'm not sure. You know more about it than I do up to date, but I just think it's an interesting parallel.
Okay. Well, you know, unfortunately, until they do human trials and we go look at the food supply and we say, okay, the grain, is it deficient in tryptophan? And then is the end product of the animal deficient in tryptophan? And then when we consume it, are the humans deficient of tryptophan? Until we do that, it's really hard to determine whether or not that's an issue. But the facts remain that the issuing of antidepressant medications has gone through the roof during the time frame in which GM crops have been around. That's fascinating. It has been a 4-time increase. And in fact, the most prescribed medication in the middle age, the younger, like 19 to 44 age group now, is antidepressant medication. So we've increased that during that time frame. So I don't know if that's associated directly, but it is fascinating that many of the mechanisms of action of these medications is to have a role in the neurotransmitter pathways. And those neurotransmitter pathways, they utilize the exact same amino acids that Roundup inhibits. So glyphosate will inhibit the formation of the exact same amino acid, the tryptophan, phenylalanine, and tyrosine for the serotonergic and dopaminergic neurotransmitter pathways. Those are what you get inhibited. Now, they do it in two ways. They'll stop that from happening in the plant. That's how the plant dies, is they inhibit that shikimate pathway that produces those. But they also do it by knocking out beneficial bacterium that also have that shikimate pathway and can produce tryptophan. Now, the problem that I'm concerned about is we know that it changes the bacterium in the soil. We know that it changes the bacterium in the animals. There are two trials now, a poultry trial and a cattle trial. And now we're going to see, you know, there hasn't been any studies in humans. But what we do see is now there are levels of glyphosate in humans. They're testing the urine in Germany and non-agricultural workers. And they're finding the level of this glyphosate, since it's sprayed in, you know, hundreds of millions of pounds every year, they're finding these levels everywhere. It's in the stream water, the lake water, it's in the rain now, it's in the air in parts of the Midwest, and they're finding in non-agricultural workers, the urine level of the glyphosate is 20 times that which would be considered safe in drinking water. So you begin to wonder, you know, well, okay, if this is a potent biocidal bacterium-killing agent, then is it possible that it's killing the bacterium in humans? We don't know. What we do know, though, is through the Autism Research Institute and through other organizations that are looking at the microbial balances in children, we're seeing shifts in bacterium that we didn't see a decade ago or 2 decades ago. So there's a lot more of the clostridial species that are surviving. There's a lot more of the pathogenic species of organisms that can cause problems leading to neurocognitive and behavioral disorders. So whether there's an association or not, we don't know, but there has been a massive change and a rise in these intestinal and neurobehavioral conditions.
For me, you know, well, it's interesting to me that over in Europe, they're banning all kinds of GMO products, right? And I just talked to a friend from Costa Rica today, and she was saying that they really got upset over there because their chickens were all getting to be a mess, but they were buying American chicken feed, so that's been banned in Costa Rica.
Oh, the chicken feed has been banned, yeah. So
But Tom, isn't that proof?
Isn't that proof? Now that's not proof. Mm-hmm. But what it is it's another piece of the picture. Now, the interesting fact that exists is there are animal husbandry workers, for example, farmers, who are raising pigs, raising cattle, who have done experiments with their pigs or cattle, or chickens in some cases, pre- and post-GMO diets. And that's the fascinating piece to me, because they haven't done that in humans, which they should. I mean, to imagine they've made it into the mass food supply with 193 pounds on average meat consumed per person per year doesn't make any sense without these experiments. But what they did in animals is they would remove the GM soya, for example, the soy, and they would see the changes in the pigs, they would see the changes in the cattle, they would see the changes in the chicken. And they were pretty profound. They would start noticing within 2 days' time. They would see a decrease in stomach upset. They would see a change in mood. Repeatedly, what you'll hear from the farmers is that the animals are happier, which is interesting. You had mentioned that earlier. So we don't know if that's what's happening with humans. We don't know. What I do know in clinical practice, personally, is the amount of people who are presenting with intestinal upset, the amount of people who are presenting with mood and behavioral disorders is much higher than it used to be. That's all I know. Whether or not that's correlated with the GM crop, I would like to know. And I read science every single day to see what dose of resveratrol is actually effective or how broccoli is actually so good for you. I love reading science. I love talking to researchers. I interview them. But I can't do that with GMO. There are no human trials. I mean, you can talk to the farmers. You can talk to the farming consultants, plant pathologists. You can talk with geneticists. And they will say, look, what I see in the animal stuff is scary. How come there's no human trials? I don't know. The actual biotech companies will not allow research on their product because, you know, it makes sense. I mean, they have a patent on a particular product. They don't want somebody going in and constructing their identical product and they'll lose profit. However, it keeps scientists from requesting the materials to do proper analysis. And once they do the analyses, the statistical analysis has to be approved by the companies as well. So it's like, you know, you really can't do a very good independent study. And then unfortunately, what's happening in the United States is the minute a scientist will come out and say, hey, I'm concerned about GMOs, or in Europe, for example, I'm concerned about GMOs, I see these adverse effects in animals, almost immediately, it's pretty clearly overnight almost, they'll say, oh, this is a discredited researcher, their statistics were not correct, their methodology was incorrect, they used the wrong control, they used the wrong animal. And you begin to wonder over time, like, how many studies can you do that to? How many studies can you say these are all pseudoscientists, it's ridiculous, before you say, wait a second, who's the pseudoscientist here? Like, who's breaking down all these studies and saying there's nothing here? A true scientist would say, that's interesting, let's replicate that data. Instead of negating it, they would say, okay, I didn't like how they did this, but this finding was interesting. For example, there was a study done in France by Professor Seralini. And Professor Seralini looked at rats, and he fed the rats Roundup corn. He fed the rats Roundup on top of the Roundup-ready corn, and then he fed just Roundup in water and versus control. And what he found is, you know, all groups had tumors. They died quicker. There was pituitary, kidney, and liver abnormalities, all sorts of problems. People didn't like how he did his statistics. People didn't like the control animal. They didn't like the control side. Whatever it was, they were arguing against. The reality is, he found a negative effect. And the only thing that was different with his study was twofold, really. Number one, instead of looking at a 90-day safety trial, he did his trial for 2 years. This is the first animal trial to look at these things and do a lifetime study. And interestingly enough, he didn't notice statistical importance until after 120 days. So instead of 90 days, it was 120 days. And he said, isn't that fascinating that everybody's doing these safety testing on 80,000-plus chemicals and GM crops and everything at 90 days? And yet you're not going to see results in the animals that will be considered obvious and statistically significant until 120 days. So everybody, I don't care how much you want to bash the statistics or you want to negate whoever he is or whatever he does, that's fine. Number one, you have to be saying, wait a second, these are pretty obvious changes. Maybe there's something here, and maybe we should reevaluate our safety process. Maybe we should be looking at all of the studies we do for chemicals, all the things we're doing for GMOs, and we'll say, wait a second, they should be for longer in case there is some sort of statistical significance at a later date. Wouldn't you want to wait to find that out? Because really, you know, some of these endocrine-disrupting chemicals we have on the marketplace now, the phthalates and the parabens and the triclosan and the BPA, they don't take effect immediately. Usually it takes years, and maybe it's up to a sixth of the lifetime of an animal. So if we're doing that same experiment on ourselves, as humans, you know, we should be doing long-term clinical trials and seeing, wait a second, what would happen if these chemicals, the herbicides, and the actual GMOs had a negative effect that took place over a long period of time? Would we see then after 14 years, 20 years of consumption, that we would start seeing an increased risk of cancers? We'd see an increased risk of kidney problems. We'd see increased risk of liver problems. We'd see these endocrine-disrupting disorders of obesity, insulin resistance, type 2 diabetes that would be going into pandemic proportions because, once again, Nancy Swanson did some more charts with insulin resistance and obesity and diabetes, and sure enough, there are correlations there too. So, you know, I think the entire process isn't studious enough. I don't think people are really looking deep enough and being critical enough of what's going on here. There's so much of this what's called substantial equivalence that's being accepted. They'll say, look, because our government said it was okay and because the FDA approved these without proper regulation, they actually deregulated in the Reagan administration initially and then on to the Bush senior administration, they deregulated the biotech crops, allowed them into the food supply, and instead of treating them like a pharmaceutical and saying, we're going to assume they're harmful until proven innocent, they said, we're going to assume they're substantially equivalent until proven harmful. But the tests that we're going to use to prove them harmful, number one, are going to be provided to us by the biotech industry, and number two, they're going to be done for what has been proven now to be an inefficient amount of time. So that doesn't seem logical to me, and I would say there are quite a few scientists out in the field who say, this is absurd. This is absolutely and totally absurd. Why wouldn't we be doing sufficient testing? Why wouldn't we be examining what's happening in humans? Because that is the end effect that we're getting now. We're selling the animals to the humans. We're selling some of the crops to the humans. Wouldn't we want to know what's happening?
But to let's jump back to the... What is the GMO? What is this whole thing that they're saying? They're trying to feed a world, a hungry world, and that's why they're doing it. It seems kind of opposite, doesn't it?
That would be wonderful. That would be so noble. That would be incredible. I really appreciate if that is truly where it's coming from. I honor that. I would say fantastic. We do have a growing population. But, you know, there was a recent study that just came out from India showing that people using standard non-chemical-based drilling techniques had some world record crops of wheat and rice and others. So I would say that, number one, GMOs don't necessarily increase yield as of yet. That's not saying they're not going to come up with some variety that's brilliant. I don't know. But the current things that we're using now, the Roundup Ready crops, the BT-tolerant crops, or excuse me, BT-producing crops, those have not increased yield. There has been some benefit. Don't get me wrong. I mean, the BT crops, really, because they produce their own toxin, their own insecticide in every single cell of the plant, have been able to reduce the use of insecticides by over 123 million pounds. So by doing that, that's phenomenal, right? I mean, that's great. Good for that. I love that. At the same time, though, because you've made a Roundup-resistant crop, you've increased the use of the herbicides by 527 million pounds. So the net increase is then 404 million pounds of pesticides, in this case the herbicides, have been used because of the introduction of GM crops. And then when you look at the actual yield studies from the introduction of this crop from the University of Washington, there has not been any increased yields. In fact, there was a report that said failure to yield. There really has been no intrinsic yield increase from the use of GM crops. Now, that's to date. And the problem we're seeing now is we're getting insects that are resistant to the Bt toxin. So now that's not working. We're getting weeds, and there's like a huge outbreak of what's called pigweed that's happening as a type of tamarind. It's happening
like frankenweed, right?
So exactly. So now we've got nature adapting to the overuse of the herbicides and the use of this Bt toxin, and so now they're not effective. So now the solution is to introduce these 2,4-D-resistant crops, the dicamba-resistant crops, which means we're going to be spraying more toxic chemicals that are meant to kill life. Herbicides are mineral chelators. They bind to minerals. And many of the insecticides will affect neurological pathways, neurotransmitter pathways in animals, in humans. We see things that have been like papyrophos in children banned in home use because of neurobehavioral disorders. And they're banned in home use, but they're still used in agriculture. So these copious use of chemicals that are designed to inhibit life, to kill things, doesn't seem to make sense on a grand scale. Mm-hmm. So we're continuing what I would consider a roller coaster of chemical use, which benefits not us, not insects, not balance of bees and butterflies and humans and soil and plants, but it benefits chemical companies. So it's quite fascinating to me that the top contributors to the vote no on I-522, which is the labeling of GMOs, are indeed chemical companies. You'll have Monsanto, you'll have Dow, you'll have Bayer, you'll have DuPont. So you'll have a lot of...
I was pretty shocked to find that the director of agriculture retired, who was from Washington State, was advertising no, vote no.
And it
messes with your head when you realize that it's all about lobbying or money or something. Listen to me be prejudiced here.
Well, you know what? I'm questioning the validity, because if you look at what he's talking about, he says it's a deceptive labeling scheme that will actually label pet food but won't label meat. That's one of his commercials. And the interesting piece is, I don't know if he's lying on purpose on camera because he's paid a large amount or if he's ignorant. But the actual initiative does not cover pet food. So I think he knows that. I'm wondering why he's spinning that in an advertisement, a commercial on national television. That doesn't make any sense to me. And then he talks about the regulation of, you know, he shows a picture of alcohol versus juice. I mean, some things are labeled, some things aren't. Well, of course they're not. I mean, the Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearm Bureau is in charge of the labeling of alcohol. It's a federal bureau. It's not a state bureau. So, like, some of the things he's doing is, like, nonsensical. And it makes me wonder, like, is he completely ignorant or completely bought out? But he's definitely not connected with what this initiative does and how it's written. Because it's not as deceptive as he makes it out to be. It's quite effectively written. It's almost mimicking the European Union's very effective policy that's in place right now. So, I begin to wonder, is it dollar motivation or is it just ignorance? I'm not sure, but either way, it's misinformation. And there's a lot of people who are buying into it, saying, oh, this has got to be like Sweetie Initiative. It's not in there at all. That's ridiculous.
Either that or people are going numb in the head. They don't know. Because it's so, for example, if you know a lot of places in Europe are outlawing anything American to eat, really. I keep hearing these stories about people saying, ooh, we wouldn't touch American things because of what's in it. And I'm like, you know, when you hear things like that, you go, well, why aren't people paying attention, you know? Maybe we don't have human studies, but aren't those human studies, you know?
Well, yeah. And the reality is people say there are no human studies. And in the scientific literature, there are no human studies that I have seen. Why they're not being conducted doesn't make any sense to me. But the reality is there are some human experiments that are occurring all the time. And that is, I have some colleagues and myself in clinical practice who will recommend GMO-free diet. And when you recommend a GMO-free diet, you specifically recommend that people avoid soy, corn, canola oil, and sugar beet sugar. And you say, hey, let's stay off of those things, and let's see if there's any sort of change in your intestinal function, your mood, your rashes, your anxiety, whatever it's going to be. And I have to say that there's quite a miraculous change that can occur with just the removal of those foods. If you start adding in things like wheat that may be laden with more Roundup because it's used to burn down the crops at the end of the season, then, you know, you start saying the allowable limit on wheat is higher than other things. And you say, well, I wonder if it's the chemicals, I wonder if it's the genetic modification. It would, from what I see, be extremely logical and prudent to actually carry out scientific studies to determine if that's the case. And if it is, wow, we've got to backtrack. We've got to really stop what we're doing. We have to stop believing all these promises and say, show me the money. Show me the science. Show me the actual data that says this is not going to harm myself or my children. Because I can go online and I can listen to Ib from Denmark, and he's talking about how his pigs get better, and then a colleague talks about his cattle getting better, and he talks about, you know. And if you go around with Dr. Don Huber, a plant pathologist from Purdue University.
What's his name? Don Huber?
Dr. Don Huber. And I've had numerous interviews with Don, and I've spent many hours talking to Don about nutritional biochemistry and crop chemistry. And the man will blow your mind. He's a walking encyclopedia. And he will flat out tell you, Tom, I'm really looking forward to a day when genetic modification serves the people and the crops and the animals. That day is not today. All I see is a rise in super weeds. I see a rise in super bugs. I see a copious amount of herbicide being used on soil, leaving the soil changed forever because it'll kill the beneficial microbes. The plants that are planted in that soil and then are sprayed over again with the glyphosate are more susceptible to disease. His analogy is fantastic. He says, you know, when you're sprayed with Roundup, it's like you're giving the plant a case of AIDS. You weaken its immune system so much that it's more susceptible to drought. It's more susceptible to disease. His primary example is something called Gosse's wilt, which, you know, was a normal fungal infection that could occur, and now is gone rampant. It's in epidemic proportions on these crops. So you kind of think to yourself, maybe nature is wise. Maybe there's a balance already out there between micronutrients in the soil, microorganisms in the soil, water, air, sunshine, all the things that the plant normally needs. Do we really need to intervene with expensive technologies? Is it possible that we could exist within the boundaries of nature versus having to tweak it and try and better what Mother Nature already had? Because I'll tell you, as I dive into the science, and I'm reading all the time about epigenetics and genetics, and I'm reading about how plant chemicals interact with the human genome and how bacterium in the soil will interact with our genome, it's phenomenal. It's phenomenal how complex and intricate and how well-balanced it is. And to assume that we can intervene and you know, up what God has done or nature has done doesn't seem to make sense. I think we might want to be a little bit more humble. We might want to be a little bit more cautious. And we might want to learn more from nature instead of manipulate nature to do our bidding.
That sounds like evolution to me.
Well, it sounds like evolution, which is, of course, it would be part of adaptation, right? I mean, we'd be adapting to our surroundings and really working within the parameters in which we were given. Now, because we have more pollution and we're using up all the farmland, is the solution to manipulate the DNA of plants to get better yield? You know what? That would be awesome if it panned out to be true. But so far, it's the exact opposite. And in fact, you know, the prime solution that we're hearing from the biotech firms that they're going to say is going to solve everything is this golden rice, right? You know, they'll say, look, we can put beta carotene in the rice, and then we give it to children who would otherwise go blind. And, you know, if you don't appreciate GMOs, then you're allowing for blindness of children all across the globe because of vitamin A insufficiency. And I say to myself, okay, I'm a nutritional biochemist. I know, well, I study nutritional biochemistry. I have 2 degrees in nutritional sciences. And I know that the actual pathway to turn beta-carotene into retinoic acid, you split it right down the middle pretty much, is enzyme-dependent, and that enzyme needs cofactors. And then the absorption process needs fatty acids to have optimal absorption. And I'm saying to myself now, wait a second. If you're just giving beta-carotene in a rice, and you're not giving adequate fat, you're not giving adequate zinc, you're not giving adequate cofactors to allow for this conversion to take place, is that even beneficial? Have they done any studies on humans? No, they have not. To see if this will actually raise the levels? No. They tried to in China, and they didn't tell the parents of the Chinese children that they were giving them genetically modified foods. They got caught, they got fined, and, you know, they're back to the drawing board now. They tried to push it through to prove that you could do this, and it didn't happen. In fact, it really set them back because now we understand their integrity is not in place. In fact, some United States departments were involved in that. So I'm not convinced yet. I'm just not convinced. I'm not going to say it doesn't work and it might not work in the future. I don't know that. What I can say is, how in the world did this get to where it is today without proper safety? How in the world are they not taking accountability for what's happening to the croplands and the crops themselves? And pretending everything is okay. I don't get that. I don't understand. It doesn't seem to make sense to me.
Well, how do you think people are doing with it? Do you think people are, many people are actually learning this? Are people studying it? I don't know. It seems like many people change the subject. They don't want to talk about it.
Well, I have to be honest with you. And there are very few geeks like myself who spend every single day reading new scientific articles and trying to educate themselves on what's happening, what's really happening. There are more people who sit in front of the television and allow the media to tell them what's happening. And, right. You know, I mean, there's an article that got released from Stanford, for example, that was just a group of doctors, not scientists or researchers, doctors who said organics don't have any sort of benefit whatsoever nutritionally, and you know, they will actually protect you very little from pesticide exposure. It's not that it's not worth your dollar. And then you look at the actual scientist's interpretation of that study and say, wow, you looked at the wrong markers, you looked at the wrong chemicals in the actual plant, you actually looked at individual studies in a way that we didn't see. We looked at the same studies and found something totally different. That's weird that you came up with those conclusions. Why are you even publishing this study? You guys aren't researchers. Like, what's this all about? And then, of course, Huffington Post picks this up and says, well, isn't that interesting? Cargill had given a very large multi-million-dollar donation to Stanford previously. Could there be a connection? And then, you know, that whether or not that's going down somewhere, I don't know. I mean, they refused it and said, no, 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 it's the wrong department, and that's not where the money comes from. But you begin to wonder how much of the recommendations are based on potential economic growth and financial gain versus benefit for humankind. Because I'm seeing every day, you'll see an article come out about fracking, or you'll see an article come out about, we just see one in Argentina that came out about Monsanto chemicals. And Monsanto argued back and said, well, sure, these people are dying, but our chemicals are perfectly safe. It's like, what? Like, did you read the article? I mean, people are exposed to your chemicals and they're dying, and you're saying your chemicals are completely safe? Like, the disconnect is amazing. I mean, the amount of millions and millions of dollars that goes into lobbying to make products look fantastic that aren't fantastic boggles my mind. And here my concern is, as a science geek and as a father, is, once again, show me the money in scientific data. Show me that there are no effects. And then logically convince me that there shouldn't be. Because if you're going to make a chemical that binds to a mineral or make a chemical that kills the energy powerhouse of a cell, why wouldn't it hurt humans? It's like saying mercury, when you inject it into a human, isn't going to have an effect. Now, I'm not saying anything about anything other than that. If you're going to take a potent neurotoxin and put it in somebody's blood, are you going to imagine it's going to have no effect? I don't know. I mean, it just, it, you know, there's certain logical things that if you have a pesticide and it's made to kill life, and it gets into the drinking water of humans, then are we to imagine that it's going to be completely and totally safe? I don't know. Logically, it just doesn't line up. So you begin to wonder how much of this is bought. How much of our confidence or assurance or confusion that's in the media is bought? Because when you buy books like, you know, the product of doubt or some of the climate cover-up books, you'll see that the industry actually pays scientists to come up with data to make people think things are safe. I read this amazing article. It was, you know, hundreds of references, and it was quite a long article. It was on pesticides, and saying pesticides really don't cause neurobehavioral disorders in children. There's really nothing here. And I looked at the article, and I was like, how in the world did they just find that? When I just read another 25 articles that show the opposite, how did this article find that? I mean, they quote all these studies. How did they find that? And then I looked down under one of the scientists' names, and it says Dow Chemical. I'm like, God. You're from Dow Chemical, and you publish this article, and there's no bias here? So I was like, okay, let me look into research, because that's what I do. And I said, oh my gosh, here's an article that shows very tight correlation between industry association and positive results for chemicals, including genetically modified crops. And I was like, oh, well, that makes sense. You know, well, you want to promote your industry, and that's how you feed your children, you allow your house to be as large as it is, or your boat or your car or whatever it is. That makes sense that you would want to protect that. But I'm kind of on the opposite end of the spectrum, where I'm thinking to myself, what is currency? What is value? Like, why are we here? Are we here so we can have a large house? Are we here so we can have a large car that we can travel around the globe? Is that why we're here? I begin to wonder, what is true value? Because true value to me seems like it would be things like health and happiness. Mm-hmm. And if you don't have clean air, and you don't have clean water, and you don't have food that supports your brain functioning, your muscle function, gives you vital energy, has you sharp as a tack, then what do you have? Because I'm beginning to think that the true currency that we have in this life are the air, the water, the food, and the deep human interaction. And
I was thinking about the media stuff that we were talking about, the lobbying is kind of like GMO thought in a way.
Well, that's interesting you say that, because when you look at neurocognitive and behavioral disorders, usually children and even adults get thrown off when there is what's called oxidative stress, when there are chemical interactions with the mitochondria, the energy powerhouse of the cells. And it's interesting that junk foods and a lot of the processed foods we're consuming, which over 70% of processed foods have GMOs in them, that those particular foods are shown to increase oxidative stress, inflammatory problems, and they will actually kill the cell's mitochondria. So you say, whoa, maybe it could be that since the mitochondria and the central nervous system are highly susceptible to damage, it could be that we are, quote-unquote, dumbing down or numbing down people to true consciousness. We're not allowing them to reach their brain potentials, their conscious potentials. There's a particular receptor in the brain called the dopamine 4 receptor. But some people would say that's what separates us from the animals that can't contemplate their existence. So you've got whales and dogs, and they can actually think about, you know, I am here on this planet, and I am doing something. I'm here for a reason. Humans especially, right? Mm-hmm. Well, when you have oxidative stress, you're exposed to chemicals that hurt your mitochondria, that harm this antioxidant called glutathione, they steal it away, then that particular receptor can't work very well. So by you saying that comment, like, you know, maybe some of these foods, that thought process could be changed by the consumption of these foods, I'm going to say, absolutely. Are you kidding me? I mean, I see clients all the time. We'll get them to clean up their diet, we'll look at their nutrient status based on what foods they're consuming, and we'll make recommendations. And, you know, they'll say, like, oh, my gosh, I have so much energy. I have such clear thought. And you'll see them make these shifts in their lives to say, I've got to let go of this bad relationship, or I have to let go of this negative thought, or it's bizarre, but it's like exactly what you're saying. It's almost as if they evolve once they change their diet.
Mm-hmm. I really love that. Hey, this is a little bit different, but do you remember way back, I know you're young, but way back, Adele Davis said, I think in the early 50s, that if they keep breaking up the food, doing fast food, then you're going to have a huge gay population by the year 2000.
Huh, that's interesting.
And that's actually a study in a way, isn't it? That's a scientific study based on humans, isn't it?
Well, yeah, it would have been nice if there were a little bit more parameters and somebody kept track of all the factors involved. But that's an interesting, I would say, observation to examine more closely.
Yeah, I find it very interesting because now I'm 100 years old, right? Well, actually, I'm a lot older than I used to be. And I watch that whole progression, just as she said, and people laughed at her, you know. But, it's just interesting to see that we will see the impact of these things on us if, as a species. I know we will.
We should expect to see an impact after every single bite that we eat. The reality is that food signals changes within the human genome. We will have more activity reading our genes within 2 hours after eating, it's called 2 hours postprandial, than we will most other times in our life. So the food is designed to speak to our genes and allow us to change how we make protein, repair ourselves, build ourselves. So, yeah, that's what food is designed to do. What I'm concerned about as a quote-unquote modern nutritionist is that we're forgetting our past, which is that's what food does, and now we're manipulating the food, and we're not even sure what effects those manipulations will have on the growth, reproduction of our cells. We do know that refined diet, junk food diet can contribute to cancer, and it just makes sense. It makes sense that you can harm the actual environment in which you're existing, and that will change the behavior of your cells themselves. So, yeah, I mean, we should be looking at all of our food, whether it's genetically modified or not.
Well, also, I mean, you work with some interesting cases. I'd love to hear some of that, but don't you find that a lot of people can feel right away if you're eating something and it's really dangerous for you, you can get an immediate feeling from that, can't you?
That depends on the person and how aware and sensitive they are. And I would say that that's not always the case because many people are kind of numbed out. They are not very aware of what's happening. Their energy level is super low. Their pain level is super high. You know, they don't quite notice the finite changes. They don't see them. I give the analogy that usually when it comes to health issues, you know, you know, Alzheimer's happens decades before it ever gets diagnosed, so does MS, so do a lot of diseases, and your body usually starts talking to you in a whisper years and years before you ever get a diagnosis. There's some little thing, like, for example, your smell or your taste when it comes to Alzheimer's will start going away, and you'll just kind of, it's no big deal, whatever. People don't notice the nuances anymore. You know, the old Native Americans, the original first people, that was their wealth. Their wealth was their awareness. They had a lot of respect for people who tried to constantly be more aware every day, that could sense animals out miles away, that could tell you where the wind was coming from and how it would shift a half an hour from now. They would sense a lot of things around them and be hyper aware, whereas we're constantly aware of our computer screens and our iPhones. So, you know, we're not quite getting in touch with how our knees feel, and if this is the early stage of rheumatoid arthritis, we're not really in touch with the fact that lower right quadrant pain might be a sign of bacteriologic imbalances in our intestinal tract. We don't go there as much. So I wish I could say people notice right away, and not everybody does. Some people, yes, but it would be nice to see more.
And so how do you teach your clients? Let's talk a little bit about your clients. I'm very interested. Do you teach them how to sense and feel that kind of thing? And
journaling. Yeah, absolutely, journaling. Yeah, so I love elimination-type diets. The data is coming out now that, you know, there's A third of the people who are presenting with IBS have a fructose intolerance. A third have a non-celiac-associated wheat sensitivity. There's a lot of things with food that people are reacting more and more to food. And that's an interesting conversation, but that would be a different talk. But, so I ask people to actually eat and then journal to identify with what it is they're feeling. Are your bowel movements changing? Has your energy level changed? Are you feeling heaviness behind your eyes? Do you get foggy thinking? Do you get joint pain? So I ask people to kind of pay attention after they eat what the senses are, what's going around in their body. And it really helps people identify what works for them and what does not.
Yeah, that's great. It's a very interesting subject that you're in. So let's go back to the GMOs, because we got a vote going on here, don't we?
We have Initiative 522, and the ballots are due November 5th, and people's ballots should have arrived on October 22nd. That is the date in which they were supposed to be mailed. And they're in people's inboxes right now, right in their mailboxes.
I'm pretty excited about it. I think, what do you think happened in California when it was voted down?
Well, the reality is the issue is safety, the issue is nutritional quality, the issue is sustainability and longevity of our food supply. I mean, they want to give us enviro pigs, and they want to give us aqua bounty salmon. They want to genetically modify the majority of the food supply so they can patent it and make technology fees on it. It makes sense. They spend billions and billions of dollars. However, you know, if one of those aqua bounty salmon gets out, there was a study that showed it could breed with trout, and then the trout would decimate the natural trout and the wild salmon population. So there's, you know, it's kind of scary to think what possibly could happen. And those are the issues. But that's not what's being talked about. They have PR firms that have polled, and they found out that you don't want to talk about the safety of GMOs because people will say, I'd rather be safe, I'll vote. Yes, label them. I want to know the safety. So instead of that, they attack the proposition, or in this case, they're attacking the initiative. They're saying it'll increase prices. Well, good luck. We just had a guy on Huffington Post who was an ex-lobbyist who worked for the Grocery Manufacturers Association, the largest contributor to the No campaign. And he said, he laughed at that. He's like, oh, you're kidding me. It's not going to raise costs. That's ridiculous. And he used to work for them. And then they're going to say, well, it's like you said, the ex-Department of Agriculture person was saying that it's going to be deceptive. They're going to label one thing and not another. Well, you know what? He's lying. He's saying they're going to label pet food. They're not. He said they're going to have an issue comparing juice versus alcohol. That's nonsensical. It's a federal issue versus a state issue. So they're spinning this propaganda, this misinformation about how the initiative is poorly written, how it's going to cost you, and they're focusing all their energy on that. They don't want you thinking about the safety of GMOs. They want you thinking about the initiative. So they'll say, well, look, it's not so bad to label GMOs, but this initiative is terrible. See, right there, their product is gout. And once they have you thinking that maybe the initiative isn't well-written, then they're like, move, they're going to vote no. And that's exactly what happened on Prop 37. I have a copy of the ballot from Prop 37. You've got to read it. It's just amazing how much propaganda was on that ballot. And
you
really,
think that would be illegal, wouldn't you? That's distorting, again, GMO of the thought.
Yeah, well, if you are trying to win a debate, you will distort ideas to manipulate someone's end result. So it makes sense they're doing what they're doing because it works. Is it ethical? No. Is it logical? No. Unless your mean is to increase the bottom line instead of to increase the quality of life of human beings on the planet. So
I was buying an organic pineapple recently, and the fellow said, boy, you're spending a lot on that, and I would just get a normal pineapple and forget it. That that's too expensive, and I said, well, cancer is pretty expensive, too, so you have to make that.
Yeah, well, pineapples are not genetically modified as of yet, but,
Some of them are. Hmm?
Yeah, it's the pesticide use. Absolutely. The focus is on the initiative right now, and it was on the top 37, and they won it, I think, off of the ballot. They wrote Top 37 is a deceptive, deeply flawed food labeling scheme full of special interest exemptions and loopholes. Prop 37 would create new government bureaucracies costing taxpayers millions, offer expensive shakedown lawsuits against farmers and small businesses, and increase family grocery bills by hundreds of dollars per year. So they use the exact same tactics that won in California in Washington State. And we've now proven every single one of those things to be completely and totally false. So it's like, wow, they're just playing by the book. They're really trying to win based off of a plan that worked.
Well, I want people to wake up because it's our life.
Well, you know what? I think when people wake up, it scares them and they go back to sleep. Because when you start seeing the truth that there are 74 billion pounds of chemicals being produced or imported in the U.S. every single day, and that doesn't include pesticides, pharmaceuticals, fuels, and food additives, then that's over 300 pounds per person per day. So that's
a lot of chemicals per day.
So when you start really looking and you start taking that red pill or blue pill, whichever it was, from the Matrix, and you start seeing the truth around you about what's happening, it can be too much to handle. So people will crawl back in the cave and say, I don't want to believe the research. I don't want to believe people who are really doing the investigation. I'd rather be told everything is okay. Ignore the warning signals. Because that's so much easier in life. I have so much stress on my plate already. I don't want to have to deal with this global problem. I don't. So that's where people are right now. They're just overwhelmed.
Well, one small thing I want to say is that some of the parts of the world are saying no, right?
64 different countries, absolutely.
Woo-hoo!
And you know, people are looking, they're looking over at the United States and going, are you insane? Like, why are you guys just buying into all this? Like, don't you see that there's something beneath this that's not being told you? And it's ridiculous. I don't know why, but talk to some Europeans and they'll definitely raise your awareness.
They feel sorry for us. Now, you know what, Tom? We're at the end of our hour, but I'd like you to tell people how to get hold of you.
Well, gosh, yeah, I'm a super busy guy. It's really hard to get a hold of me, but you can view our blog at nourishingmeals.com, and our website is at wholelifenutrition.net.
And I hear great things about your cookbook, too.
Oh my gosh. And our cookbook, of course, Nourishing Meals, which is going gangbusters right now, but it's basically talking to people about everything I'm mentioning here in a book and then partnering it with amazing, incredibly delicious recipes. My wife is a genius in the kitchen.
Wonderful. Well, we have to say goodnight to you and good luck, and I'm really, really pleased that you helped us wake up about the whole GMO thing and the bill that's coming up, 522. Thanks for your great work, Tom.
Yeah, I have to do it. You know, my kids rely on me to do the best I can as a protector and provider, so I just have to do it.
Well, bless your heart. Good for you. Thank you. And thank you so much for being a paradigm shifter.
It's a pleasure. Keep up the great work.
Okay, good night. Good night, everybody. Thank you so much for listening. Many blessings.